about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
The disclaimer, so nice you got to hear it twice, but no legal ID. That's the lovely thing about live radio. You are tuned in to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is our April 12th, 2017 edition, and we are doing what we do every single Wednesday morning, which is chat with writers. I'm your engineer today, but I am not your interviewer. My name is Marie Stone, but I'm lucky enough to be joined this morning by a dear friend, an amazing writer, an incredible interviewer who is going to be doing all of the interviewing this morning, Chris Bonson. I know him as CJ, so I might slip up and call him CJ, but Chris Bonson is an assistant editor with Narrative Magazine. His writings have appeared in River Teeth, The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, Smithsonian Air and Space Magazine, and Downbeat. He is currently working on a collection of stories based on his years working and living in trailer parks in Newport Beach, California. I cannot wait for that. My favorite thing, trailer parks. CJ, welcome.
Oh,
Chris,
thanks.
Welcome.
Thank you, Marie. That was way too generous, your intro, by the way.
No, this is so fun to have you here.
I'm so glad you're here guiding the ship.
We'll see. Don't thank me yet. But you, you've got an amazing guest this morning. Who have you got?
Yeah, we're going to have Minjin Lee for the full hour. And would you like me to tell you a little bit about her?
Absolutely.
Okay. Minjin Lee's debut novel, Free Food for Millionaires, was one of the top 10 novels of the year for The Times of London, NPR's Fresh Air, and USA Today. Her short fiction has been featured on NPR's Selected Shorts and most recently appeared in One Story. It's an awesome story, by the way. It's kind of a chapter right out of Pachinko for people that would like a little taste of Pachinko. Check out her short story in One Story. Anyway, her essays and criticism have been anthologized widely. Her new novel, Pachinko, is a national bestseller, a New York Times editor's choice, and has been listed as a top read or a most anticipated book for BBC.com, Publishers Weekly, Newsweek.com, and Esquire, among others. Min joins us from New York this morning. Hi, Min. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Chris, and hi, Marie. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
It's an honor to have you. It's really great to have you here. And I wanted to start by getting the obvious question out of the way. The title of the book, Pachinko. Okay, so that's an adult pinball game that originated in Japan, first half of the 20th century, and has to do with gambling. And It plays very strongly into your plot and structure. Can you take it from there? Tell us about that.
Oh, absolutely. I think that what's interesting is that most people don't know that pachinko is a $203 billion industry in Japan.
Wow.
$203 billion, which means that it's twice the export revenues of the Japanese auto industry.
That's incredible.
Right? And the Japanese do make good cars.
And it's still going today, isn't it? Is it that?
Absolutely. That number actually comes from The Economist for last month.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So one out of 11 people in Japan play pachinko weekly. That said, the book is not about that. The book is just about the fact that it's an industry dominated primarily by the Korean people who are Japanese as well. So they're ethnically Korean, but they're culturally Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why that occurred is because in Japan, when the Koreans arrived in around 1910, until now even, ethnic Koreans are not allowed to have ordinary jobs because they're considered foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1910, that makes a lot of sense. But even today, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense because they're still perceived as foreigners even after four generations.
Wow.
So in order for Koreans to get jobs, if they're ethnically Korean and culturally Japanese, they had to often go into small businesses. Mm-hmm. And one of the small businesses, which became very lucrative, was pachinko. So that industry is dominated by Koreans who are ethnically Korean. And then they were able to prosper, but not everybody. But what's important is that I think for any of us who have gambled, whether it's in Las Vegas or Atlantic City or any of those places, we know that the house always wins. And one of the points that I wanted to talk about is that when you have a people who are living in a nation that is rigged against them, what do they do? And in all of my interviews, I learned that the Koreans actually keep playing on. They didn't give up. They really struggled and survived. And even today, there are about 600,000 ethnic Koreans in Japan. And their attitude about Japan is that it is their adopted nation. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, they really want to be ordinary good citizens, and they want to be accepted. And some of them, they really do feel accepted.
So it's kind of fair to say pachinko is a, in a way, a survival mechanism for these ethnic Koreans, correct?
Yeah, it's actually an employment haven for ethnic Koreans because they couldn't get jobs becoming postal workers or taxi drivers or hired in regular positions. I'm not even talking about ruling class white collar jobs. I'm talking about ordinary jobs were not available to ethnic Koreans because they're perceived to be foreigners. And they also are perceived to have kind of morally suspect characters.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you this. The story opens in 1910, around the time the Japanese colonization occurred in Korea. And then it spans three generations of a family, Sunja being kind of the matriarch. And then it goes till 1989. I was just curious, why did you choose to end it in the year 1989?
Well, it's kind of funny that you asked that question because 1989 is the year that I learned about the ethnic Koreans in Japan. I was 19 years old and I was a junior in college and I didn't know anything about the ethnic Koreans in Japan. And I kind of thought it'd be interesting to end it in 1989. Which is doing a full circle, because I spent most of my life writing this book. Mm-hmm. And the second reason is that I wanted to stop history when technology becomes such a huge factor.
Oh, interesting. Well,
so in this book, you're not going to find cell phones. You're not going to find fax machines. You're not going to find the internet.
True. And, you know, I wanted to ask you about, POV here. The book is written in third person omniscient, and what mm-hmm. struck me is how elegantly you move between the different character POVs and the narrator's higher POV. It's so graceful and well executed. Can you talk about that process of how you balanced and separated all those POVs in pachinko?
Oh, thank you so much for saying that, because the point of view is so important to me. I think it is the most important decision that a fiction writer makes. And I think we could have lots of stories that we want to tell, but I think the point of view is the one that the author has to ultimately make. And then once the author makes that decision, he needs to figure out how that affects the impact of the story. So if you look at every single scene of this book, you'll realize that the point of view is for pretty much everybody. And that's what the omniscient narration can take. And I think that I have a personal bias towards omniscient narration because I think, and this is going to sound a little nuts, good. I've always felt a little left out or a little bit awkward in lots of situations. Mm-hmm. So I'm often really interested in people who are kind of marginal. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes the most important person in the room is not that important to me. And I'm very curious about the person who's kind of standing outside the door. And as you know, if you choose a point of view of the person outside the door, you're going to have a very different story than the person who's giving the speech or who has the most power or money or status. So in order for me to have every single person's point of view, I had to do omniscient narration. And the way I trained how to write that point of view is I steeped myself in 19th century novels, which use it a lot, pretty much exclusively.
Mm-hmm.
And that allowed me to have the author narrator as well as every other person's point of view. And it's really fun to do. The hardest thing, I think, is to feel comfortable with it. And I think I feel very comfortable with it now. But when I first started doing it, it was really weird because it can feel very artificial if you don't do it right. But what ended up happening for me was I had to trust myself and say, oh, I want to be in Marie's point of view. I want to be in Chris's point of view. I want to be in my point of view. And in order to advance the scene, whose thoughts do I want to focus on? So that had to constantly work. And I had to trust my sympathies. And that's really how I ended up doing it in the most natural way, is to be honest about my sympathies.
It's funny because that takes me right into this other question. But, you know, just from corresponding with you and such before the show, I get a sense that you're such an honest person with a lot of humility. And and so this novel has a lot of strong themes and emotions like shame, the burden of guilt, surviving adversity, and alienation that you kind of spoke of at any cost. So they're very present in Pachinko, so strongly portrayed that I wondered if there were similar themes or emotions going on in your actual life. You sort of hinted at that somehow bled into the novel while you were writing it.
Oh, golly. Well, thank you so much. I do want to make a note of the fact that I've enjoyed our pen pal status.
So have I. I feel like I know you already.
Yeah, I know, because we're pen pals.
We are.
I mean, you can't get rid of me now.
Good, good. I'm glad to hear that.
That's one. And the second thing is, I think that if I had to be honest, and I think about this all the time,
mm-hmm.
I do feel like a failure so often about what I've been given. And it's not an exaggeration. I struggle with it a lot, and I don't talk about it that much because it sounds like I'm looking for praise, and I'm not. It's just that when you're writing, it's so difficult to achieve this thing that you have in your mind. Mm-hmm. And I think every writer feels this way.
Sure.
And also, I'm 48 years old, and I have been working on this book more or less since 1996.
Wow.
So I'm nuts.
Writers
are
nuts.
There's something wrong with me. And I've never been blocked. Like, I've never been blocked. So it's not even something, you know, convenient like writer's block. I've actually been working on it.
Uh-huh.
So, and I got the idea in 1989. And people often ask me, are you serious? And I'm like, yes, because a section of this book was published in 2002.
Oh.
So I could prove the fact that I've been working on this. And I got a fellowship, actually, in the 90s on this book project. And that's the reason why I thank the New York Foundation for the Arts, because mm-hmm. if it wasn't for them giving me $7,000, I wouldn't have been able to take a class I wanted to take in California. So there's so many different factors which inform the way I work. And this goes back to your question about shame and guilt and a sense of humiliation.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the funny things about being an outsider, and I think all writers feel like outsiders, I've never met a writer who doesn't feel like an outsider, is that sometimes you wonder, maybe the insiders are right. So when you're really being honest about being an outsider, you don't say, oh, the insiders are wrong. You actually think the insiders are right.
That's true.
Like, there's a very good reason why you weren't invited to the party.
So, right.
And if that's the case, because if you're being emotionally and intellectually honest, maybe there's a reason why you're on the fringes. Maybe you're not good enough. And I think that anxiety has often been something that's in my consciousness as a writer, and I keep thinking, like, I got to get better. I have to work harder on this, and maybe I misunderstood. So in some ways, it's very helpful because it makes me work harder, but in other ways, it's very crippling because it's exhausting to feel like you have to keep going.
I hear you.
Yeah.
I do. And before I ask you this, Marie, do we still have time before we end the first?
You're all good.
We have plenty of time.
Ask
There's
away.
No clock you
there
know, here.
Oh, yeah. No, I got your back.
That's behind me. Okay. I want to ask you about voice then, the voice of this novel, which is, you know, beautifully done. You know, it's the story opens with a kind of fabulistic tone. You're immediately dropped into this world, turn of the century, and you know, it's a wonderful voice which evolves more modern as the decades elapse in the novel. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, you know, because it took so long for you to write this book, although books take all different lengths or time to write, at what point in your drafting process did you discover the voice for this novel? Was there a moment? Or did you have to look back on a piece of writing and go, oh, there's the voice right there in this little section? When did you arrive at that voice?
Oh, that's a really good question. You know, I have to say that the voice of Pachinko is very similar to the voice of Freak with the Millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
And that was intentional. The only thing that is a big difference is what you just noticed as a fabulistic voice, because that first chapter is meant to sound like a fable.
Okay.
It's absolutely intentional. And I wanted to make it seem like once upon a time.
Yeah, that's how it reads.
Yeah, that was intentional. And I did that because I wanted to tell the story about one family located very specifically within one history. And in terms of when do I discover the voice, I have a funny story because when my son was less than a year old, this is 1998,
mm-hmm.
I went to a really cool thing called the Swanee Writers Conference, where I was able to take a class with Rick Moody and Alice McDermott, and I was surrounded by all these incredible writers. And at that point in time, I had not published one story. But it wasn't for lack of trying. Like, I had a whole binder full of rejections from everybody.
Don't we all?
Yeah, well, mine was pretty thick. So I was sending it out. I was sending lots of stuff out. I was creating lots of drafts. And the whole time I kept on thinking, why did you quit being a lawyer? Are you an idiot? So because it wasn't like I was like I had a lot of money or a lot of protections. It was just I felt so stubborn about this wish to be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I was at Swanee. And I sent something in to my class, and a very smart person said to me, you know, man, you're writing this, but it doesn't sound like the way you talk. He said, why don't you just try write one story where you sound like the way you talk? Because the way I talk can be vernacular, but for the most part, I'm a very formal person.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, I could do both. And I did, and that story was the first story I ever published.
Oh, wow. Well,
so that was very good advice for me. So I thought, whatever you actually sound like,
mm-hmm.
I think it's worth investing in using that voice. So
yeah.
I'm not somebody who uses a lot of slang or a lot of cliches when I speak. So then
mm-hmm.
in my writing, pretty much you're getting the way I sound.
That's interesting. Speaking of how you sound, would you read a little something for us?
Sure. You know, I think I'm going to read, I thought I would read the scene that we talked about.
If you wish.
Absolutely. It's on page 113 of the book. It's a very, very short section. I'm going to talk a little bit about who's in the scene. It's my main character, Sanja, and it's her husband, Isak.
Yes.
They are married, and this is not quite their wedding night, but it's the night in which they sleep together for the first time after their marriage.
Mm-hmm.
she is pregnant with another man's child. So that's worth noting that she's pregnant, and she's very pregnant.
Okay.
Neither of them spoke, and they listened to the street noises, a woman yelling at our children to come inside, a group of tipsy men singing off-key, "Adirang, Adirang, Aradio." Soon, they could hear Yosef snoring and Kyunghee's light, steady breathing as if they were lying beside them. Ishak put his right hand on her belly, but felt no movement. She never spoke about the baby, but Ishak often wondered what must be happening to the growing child. "A child is a gift from the Lord," he said. "It must be, I think." "Your stomach feels warm," he said. The skin on the palms of her hands was rough with calluses, but the skin on her belly was smooth and taut like fine fabric. He was with his wife, and he should have been more sure of himself, but he wasn't. Between his legs, his cock had grown to its full measure. This thing that had happened to him each morning since he was a boy felt different now that he was lying beside a woman. Of course, he had imagined what this might be like, but what he hadn't anticipated was the warmth, the nearness of her breast, and the fear that she might dislike him. His hand covered her chest, its shape plush and heavy. Her breath changed. Tenda tried to relax. Hansu had never touched her like this with such care and gentleness. When she had met him on the cove, sex was initiated in haste and her not knowing what it was supposed to mean. The awkward thrusting, his face changing with relief and gratitude, then the need to wash her legs in cold seawater. He used to stroke her jawline and neck with his hands. He had liked to touch her hair. Once he wanted her to take her hair out of her braids, and she did so, but it had made her late in returning home. Within her body, his child was resting and growing, and he could not feel this because he was gone. Sanja opened her eyes. Ishak's eyes were open, too, and he was smiling at her, his hand rubbing her nipple, and she quickened at his touch. "Yebo," he said. He was her husband, and she would love him.
Ah, very nice. Very nice.
Thank you.
You read that really well, too.
Thank you. That's a really good example of where you're in multiple points of view.
Mm-hmm.
You have two people on the scene, and at the moment of their consummation of their marriage, she's actually thinking about the only other time she's had sex with another man, Hansu. And for me, I was trying to figure out, like, what would she be thinking the first time she has sex? And for a young woman who hasn't had sex with more than one person,
mm-hmm.
when she has sex again, of course she would think about another person. So I had to keep following the transit of sympathies in order to write that scene.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes. You did that so well. You follow that sympathy of the character, of each character. But, you know, I love how you write about sex and love scenes in this book, because that scene, for example, stops short of the full act. We know what happens after that. Whereas there's another scene later, for example, where Kim is in the back of a bar, and he beds with a young prostitute, and
mm-hmm.
that goes till, climax literally and figuratively. And yet, you know, both scenes do the same amount of plot push, and they do the same amount of character development. In that other scene, we sense Kim's loneliness and craving for love, especially that woman, is it Kyunghee?
Yeah.
Is that her name?
Mm-hmm.
Who he sees every day, but he can't be with her because she's married, yet he has to work with her. And so he's sort of channeling that craving into this prostitute that was bought for him by his boss. And
exactly.
I just, you know, how do you make decisions like that of where you're going to stop a sex or love scene and how far you're going to go?
Oh, you know, it's very funny that you asked that question, because I think whether it's a sex scene or whether it's a fight scene, and I mentioned fighting and sex in the same breath because they're both scenes about contact. And they're both scenes in which a conflict actually has a physical contact. Because even sex is a conflict.
Mm-hmm.
It may seem like a reunion or a reconciliation or a consummation, but sex as a physical act is not always about attraction. It's about two people making a decision to physically be together or not. And there could be resistance. And sometimes, I mean, one of the things that I really like about being age 48 mm-hmm. and having been married for over 20-something years and having had a child who's now in college is that I can sort of sound like a mature woman, or at least think like one. And I think about how when you're younger, as a kind of like a good girl, you're not allowed to talk about sex or think about sex. And I think sometimes I have to put on my artist hat and just think about and examine whether it's sex or whether it's fighting or whether it's a business transaction. And I look at it in a very clinical way, and then I sort of diagnose what I have to do, and then I go back and, very importantly, think about the sympathies. But it can't really be without one without the other. It's almost like the editor and the writer have to be in communication, but the editor has to be almost clinical in terms of thinking about what is sex, what is a fight, what is a business transaction, all things that require more than one person, and mm-hmm. all things which eventually have aspects of conflict in them.
Which, again, speaks to that, you know, third-person omniscient. You know, it's a group of people. We're not stuck in first-person POV.
Mm-hmm.
And, Marie, is it time to take a little break, by the way?
We can take a little break, yeah. God, I love this interview.
Me too.
I kind of forget that I'm supposed to do something because I'm just caught up in everything you guys are talking about.
Yeah, she's been over there zoned out listening.
Yeah, this is fantastic. This is fantastic. But I am here to remind our listeners that you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Min Jin Lee, thank God, is going to be with us for the full hour. So we're going to take a very short break, but we will be right back here with her and keep listening to this great stuff.
Stay you guys tuned. Are so great. Thank you so much for having me. I love these questions you do. They're such like good writer questions.
I love your answers.
All right. Stay tuned. Hold on.
Find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at KUCI.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You are listening to us live. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. You can always follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter, and you can find podcasts of this show and other shows up on our website. You can visit penonfire.com for direct downloads of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shows. You can follow us on iTunes, and this show is going to join those shows up there for your listening pleasure. I am your engineer, Marie Stone. CJ, Chris Bonson, is your interviewer, and Minjin Lee is your guest, and we're going to carry on. I'm loving this interview. It's so hard to sit as the engineer and not, you know, I just feel like we should all go out for wine and chat more about this. But one thing you said... one thing you said, Min, about writing this novel over the course of 30 years, I was just going to ask you, that it feels like if you were writing a novel over that period of time and, you know, the book comes out, it almost feels like it would be sort of a death to not have this in your life for as long as it's been in your life. And I was wondering if there was some sort of period of mourning or how weird it feels now that you kind of don't have this anymore to play with.
Oh, that's such a good question. I like that a lot because I've been thinking about this, and I have to confess that I was so happy when the book ended because it was such a, it felt like a death sentence in a way because I couldn't stop working on it. And I wonder like how people who have businesses feel like when you're putting in bad money after good or good money after bad, depending upon how the business actually works out, you don't really know, but you just keep putting in more time. And I think all of us can agree that time is so much more valuable than money. And I put in so much of my energy and my life into this book. And as I was doing it, I never felt any encouragement externally because you're working on a novel. I had published something in 2002, and that manuscript totally died. And I had to start all over again in 2007, and I sold it in 2016. So I remember when my agent actually said that she could sell it, I just felt like, fine, go sell it. I need to go on because this is killing me. And it sounds so dramatic, but I really felt so stupid the whole time. So to answer your question, did I feel grief? A part of me feels like, oh, that book is out in the world. I'm done. And there's another part of me that really feels like I can't believe I'm on the radio, and I can't believe that Chris Bonson has read this book so carefully and is talking to me about it because, no, I'm totally serious, because a part of me when I was working on it was like, I'm making a profound mistake with my life. I'm going to be 50,
right.
And I've spent my entire life doing this thing, and nobody cares. And nobody cares because there's not a single book written originally in English about the Korean Japanese people. And again, this is like the whole thing of being the outsider. You're thinking, it doesn't exist because nobody wants it. And you're an idiot because you think that it's important. So I never thought, oh, they're all wrong and I'm such a genius. I actually thought, no, they're all right. And I picked the wrong book. Or I picked the wrong career. I mean, whatever, depending upon what day of the week it was, it was like, you made another wrong choice, so You're an idiot. So I remember going to talk to my agent, and at this point, I had a new agent on my last book, and that's another story. Mm-hmm. I just felt like, oh, thank you, Suzanne. You're going to sell this book, and I could go on. And if this book does not go out in the world in a good way, I can still feel like I honored this wish that I had that was stubborn and perhaps foolish.
Well, thank God you wrote it, and because no one else has, which is why after I finished this book, I felt really dumb. Speaking of stupid, which you are not, because it made me realize I knew absolutely nothing about the Japanese colonization of Korea, let alone that there's this population of ethnic Koreans in Japan. And so it made me also appreciate more than ever, you know, the importance of historical fiction. But I felt better when I found out that the reason I didn't know about this is nobody's written about it in English
right.
before you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's like a really crazy thing, but thank you for saying all those kind things. I felt very strongly that it was important to me, but it is 600,000 people in this world. There are 600,000 ethnic Koreans in Japan. Even today, they're really not accepted as Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And that was important to me, but I didn't know why you would care about it or anybody else. And I remember thinking, okay, well, this book better be good to read. It can't just be a political book. It has to be something that's enjoyable to read. And if it's not enjoyable to read, then you have no right to ask somebody to pay $27 for a hardcover book. And I do feel this way because I review books. Mm-hmm. And when I read a book and that's not very good, I feel like, oh, I want my money back. I do feel this way. So that's something that's important to me in terms of what does an author owe a reader? Like if a reader is generous enough to, one, pay for a book or borrow a book, but most importantly, give me 10, 20 hours of their lives, I feel very strongly that I have to come to the party and I have to bring a good covered dish.
Which is why then... You chose to write all these, write all this history as fiction rather than nonfiction, even though you probably had enough material after interviewing all these ethnic Koreans while you were in Japan. You knew you wanted to go and turn it into a great story to make the historical medicine go down easier, so to speak. although there's no sense of taking medicine here. Let me make that clear. But
I think it's very important that I personally like to read a lot of history books that are academic. So I'm actually the right person to write this book because I read a lot of ethnographies and anthropology and sociology books that actually are listed in the back. Because I wanted the whole world to think, if you're interested in this topic and you read this novel and you want to go deeper, please look at the works of all these scholars who have spent their lives dedicated to the Koreans in Japan. That said, I think that some nonfiction that's out there right now are absolutely amazing because nonfiction writers now are using all the techniques of fiction to tell a story. And I think, as a matter of fact, fiction writers have to compete against nonfiction writers who are better at telling stories than fiction writers. And I think that's probably a good thing overall for all readers because we're getting better stories. But it is hard to figure out what's hype and what's actually good. And that's the reason why I think readers' points of view are so important to me because if a reader actually says, I enjoyed this book, then that's very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, that's so true about nonfiction. It has really stepped up its game. And I know a lot of workshops are teaching nonfiction as a creative, you know, storytelling process now. The genre or the difference between the two is being erased. But I wanted to ask you... You go to Tokyo 2007 after your husband took a job there and you spent 4 years there. That's where you began to seek out and interview Koreans in Japan to interview as research. I just wondered, how did you find these ethnic Koreans and then coax them to share these very personal stories with you? How did you do that?
You know, it's funny that you ask that because a lot of people have asked me that question because they're notoriously difficult to speak with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like if you meet an Asian American in America and you learn later on, I'll say, oh, he survived the Vietnam War, right?
Right.
And you're thinking, oh, maybe he'll speak to me about it, and most likely he won't. So, but it takes time to get at somebody to trust. And also, a lot of Asians, and I'm going to make a big generalization here, they have experienced a lot of 20th century trauma, which they don't want to revisit, and rightfully so. Like, you don't want to talk about sad stories all the time. And what you and I might find interesting, somebody else might think that's really private,
mm-hmm.
which makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went to Japan, people learned that I was working on this book, and sometimes they would make introductions. And the introductions, because they came from the right people, yielded an interview. And I could always tell that they were really suspicious of my intentions. Again, they had every right to be. So what ended up happening was, eventually, when they did realize that I was entirely harmless, I write fiction.
Right.
What happened was, this kind of floodgates opened, because they were dying to talk about it to somebody. And then once I got the green light from a certain community, then they started wanting to talk and talk and talk.
Oh, that's great.
So there are three different communities of Koreans in Japan. You could be ethnically Korean, and you could have a South Korean passport, even though you've never been to South Korea. You could be somebody who identifies with North Korea, and you don't have a passport, which means that you can't travel, because North Korea and Japan don't have a diplomatic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could be a Japanese citizen, but people in Japan will never see you as Japanese, because you are by blood, and ethnically, you're not Japanese.
Right.
So it isn't like you saying that, oh, Minjin, you're an American because I'm naturalized. And I don't think you're thinking about my blood or my phenotypical features.
Mm-hmm.
In Japan, you and I could become Japanese citizens. It's very, very difficult, but you and I could probably do it. But no one would ever say Chris is Japanese or Min is Japanese.
Mm-hmm. God, it's so layered over there. My God.
It is. But what was going back to your question about interviewing is that I had to find people from all three groups. And I did, but the first few interviews were the toughest, but then afterwards, it was easy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fascinating stuff. But I wanted to go back to the nuts and bolts of how you wrote this, because, it's such an epochal novel, and a lot of bad things happen to most of these characters, yet they retain their own will. They make their own choices amid all these things they can't control. So I just wonder, how do you keep your characters from falling victim to plot determinism where, you know, all they're doing is reacting instead of to external factors? You know, your characters, what I really loved is they maintain their own will amid their dire circumstances.
Oh, you know, it's very funny. In this situation, being a Presbyterian is very helpful. Because and by that I mean, if you're a Presbyterian, you believe in fate, and you also believe in free will.
Oh.
So, thanks to John Calvin, I am constantly thinking about fate and free will.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's say you and I have a conflict. It would be very important for me, as a Presbyterian, to think about what's intended of our conflict and what I choose to do about the conflict. And I think about this for all of my characters. So sometimes you have events of history that have nothing to do with what you chose. But then upon that occurring, what will you do? But I do think that some people tend to be more reactive or active, but actually I think all of us are both.
True, that's human nature. It's just
right.
That I know a lot of writers, at least in the early years, they fall into that trap of just, you know, having plot drag their character through a story rather than, you know, working on the other side of it. And
But isn't this the best part about becoming an older person? Like, I mean, I think you're younger than I am, but one of the things that I really like about being older is I do feel a sense of authority of certain situations that I didn't feel in my 20s. I certainly didn't feel in my 30s. And as I approach being 50, if I'm fortunate, I like the fact that I can say yes, no, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because I know what's important to me.
Yeah, yeah. Wisdom is nice. as far as me being younger than you, yeah, let's go with that. Let's just say that.
Let's go with that. I don't know.
Let's just leave it at that. maybe now would be a great time for you to read to us again, if you would like.
Oh, I'd be happy to. Okay. I'm going to read a section actually toward the end of the book, and it's sort of how my character Noah ends up working in a pachinko parlor, even though that's never been what he wanted. My character Noah leaves Waseda University, a very hard-won position in life, but that he has to leave for his personal reasons, and he ends up in a town of Nagano where he meets a very kind restaurant owner named Bingo. And Bingo is trying to figure out what Noah should do with his life.
Okay.
A young man like you could work in lots of places. Let me think. Bingo's round face grew serious. He tapped his chin with his index finger. You seem very smart. Oh, I don't know about that. But that's very kind of you to say. Noah smiled. The waiter made a face. Sir, I don't know if you're picky, but if you need work right away, the pachinko parlor hires people from out of town. Office jobs are not so common lately. Pachinko. Noah tried not to look offended. Did the waiter think he was Korean? Most Japanese never assumed he was Korean until he told them his Korean surname, Boku. His identification card from Waseda stated his surname, Nobuo Bando. Noah wasn't sure why he had dropped the do from his surname when he introduced himself to Bingo, but now it was too late to change it back. I don't know about pachinko. I have never. Oh, I didn't mean to offend you. They pay very well, I hear. The Kano-san, the manager of the best pachinko parlor in Nagano, is a great gentleman. Maybe you wouldn't work in any ordinary pachinko parlor, but Cosmos Pachinko is a grand establishment run by an old family in the area. They change their machines very often. However, they do not hire foreigners. Eh? They do not hire Koreans or Chinese, but that will not matter to you since you're Japanese. And Bingo nodded several times. Soda, Noah agreed. Takano-san is always looking for office workers who are smart. He pays handsomely, but he cannot hire foreigners. And Bingo nodded again. Yes, yes, Noah said sympathetically, sounding as if he understood. Long ago, he had learned how to keep nodding, even when he didn't agree, because he noticed that the motion alone kept people talking.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Noah was really a profound character in that novel for me, as I'm sure he was for many other readers, and because he really wanted to be just part of humanity. I love that little part where that girlfriend he had, I don't care that you're not Japanese. I don't care that you know, she thinks she's being magnanimous, and he's going, right. Oh, she thinks she's doing me a favor, and done. He was done with her. You know, he had
right.
some pride, but He was a beautiful character. Well, we're nearing the
end. I mean, Noah's really important to me for a lot of reasons, but one of the things that I think people don't talk about in this book, but I think that you're going to feel in this book, is how much I wanted to explore masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say, if you are an oppressed minority, how do you choose to be a man? Because cross-culturally, men want to provide for their families, defend women, defend their children, and defend themselves. That's cross-culturally and throughout the t- you know, since the beginning of time, I think this is a fair thing to say about what men want and what masculinity requires.
Yeah, I can vouch for that.
Good. I'm so glad. I was like, are we going to have a conflict? What I thought was interesting to me is, well, if you are an oppressed minority and the social norms don't allow you to be a man, then what do? So every single one of my male characters is taking on the question of what will make me a man. And Noah answers his question by saying, I'm going to do everything right. I'm going to be the best person I can possibly be in this country, and then they will think that I'm a man.
Mm-hmm.
But he is an excellent student. He is an excellent athlete. He's always by the book. He's never greedy. He's totally virtuous in so many different ways. And that's how he chooses to be a man. Like my character Kim decides that he will be a man ultimately by being a patriot. So, and all the other characters like Moses decide, oh, well, you know, I'm going to be a man because I'm going to make money. I'm going to make so much money that you have to think that I'm a man.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think that that's how most men are dealing with how to be men in this world, but depending upon your field. So, and that will make me a man. In the same way, I think women have this question too, but they have different ways to answer the question because of the biology.
Right. That is profound. You know, a man feels emasculated if he cannot provide but feel like a man while he's doing it. That's still kind of the age old.
Except that, like, it's depending upon your field, right? So, like, let's say you're a priest. In order to be a man in that world, it's not about money,
mm-hmm.
but it's necessarily about being publicly virtuous or humble or good. And I think that in America, there's all these weird expectations of men that still exist, which don't make sense anymore.
I
think one of the things is about money.
Yes. It's getting harder every week, every year. But I guess the tragic thing is we're almost out of time. I wanted to say how wonderful it was to sit here with you and to be here with have Marie as our engineer and our co-pilot. Marie, thanks so much, and thank you to you, men. And I don't know, Marie, is there time for that last stock question that we always ask our guests?
I think you've got 30 seconds.
Okay, why don't you ask it out of tradition?
the tradition is always to ask writers if they have advice to give other writers, a huge portion of our listening audience are writers. Do you have stuff you've learned a lot across the past 30 years of writing this that you can share?
I think I have two tiny pieces of advice. Normally I don't like to give advice, but the first one is I'm just reciting what Grace Paley said, and she says that writers should have a low overhead.
Right.
I always thought that was genius. And the second thing is something that I once heard at a sermon, which I always say when people ask me what the writer's advice is, and it's to choose the important over the urgent.
That's fantastic.
I always try to choose the important over the urgent. And that's the difference between active and being reactive.
Oh, that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I love that. This was a pleasure.
It sure
CJ,
was.
You're a natural.
Really?
You're a superstar.
CJ, you did a great job. Thank you. I loved your questions. They're so good.
Well, your book made it easy, man. Thank you.
Aww.
And really a privilege to have you here. And
I'm really looking forward to your book on trailer parks. When's that coming out? What are you going to do with it?
Oh, did you hear that?
Yes.
No pressure, CJ.
Yeah. I'm just going to keep, you know, finishing the stories right now and then see what I can do with it. Try to get a few published in Lit Mags, of course. You know that game.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'll keep you posted. Keep us posted of you know, your next book, and we hope you'll come on again at that time.
Yeah, Mint, can people follow you online? Where do we find you?
I'm everywhere.
Everywhere. Isn't that great?
I'm on Twitter. I have a website. I have Facebook. I have Instagram. And I do. They tell me to do all these things. So I do them. But they tend to, it's kind of embarrassing, I got to tell you. Because, you know, that is the one weird thing about being 48 and being Asian and female is that it's so weird to talk about yourself all the time.
You do,
but
so.
It's all out there.
Well, you've got an amazing tale to talk about, so it's good that we can find you, and it's good that you're easy to stalk, so that's perfect.
Thank you, Marie.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, man.
That's all the time we have for today. CJ was fantastic. You have been tuned in to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. One quick reminder before we sign off. Today, Wednesday, April 12th, is the extraordinary day of giving back to the university. Today is UCI Giving Day. It's a 24-hour online fundraising campaign that will make a huge impact for our students and our community, transforming the lives of many through groundbreaking research and teaching. Please visit givingday.uci.edu today. It's a 24-hour thing. Any amount makes a difference. April 12th, that is today. So don't forget about that. And stay tuned for more awesome music coming up next. And thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.